We are joined on the Green this week by University of Delaware Department of Political Science and International Relations Chair David Redlosk. David, thanks for joining us on the Green this week.
You bet. Happy to be here.
Well, when we first booked this interview on Monday, I figured it would be a pretty boilerplate type of interview where we'd have you kind of look at what happened with the Iowa caucuses, talk about your experiences out there over the past 6 months while you're on sabbatical. And instead, we got a whole different thing to consider altogether. As a matter of fact, I guess, at last check, I don't know if we even have the full results yet, do we?
No, they've posted what they say is 96% of the count. But, you know, the Iowa Democratic Party is still tracking down the last few precincts, partly because the reporting app, the electronic reporting system, apparently did not work. They're now looking at the physical paper copies, which are the official record. And a few of them have been dropped in the U.S. mail because that's what people were told to do if they couldn't get them to their county chair. So they're still waiting on a few to come in.
So let's start with Monday night and just ask you what it was like to be on the ground in Iowa as these caucuses were taking place, and then literally nothing, no results because of this app snafu that they're just kind of now recovering from.
Right. I mean, the caucus day itself is always really interesting. There's, you know, some last-minute candidate efforts out there. People are just getting organized. Of course, all the action really starts taking place at 7 o'clock Central Time when the caucuses are called to order. There are just slightly fewer than 1,680 precincts across the state, every one of which held a caucus. And so I went to a caucus in Des Moines, Iowa, to observe. The caucuses are open to the public. And there was a lot of buzz and a lot of excitement. No question about it. And a lot of back and forth between supporters of various candidates and efforts to attract people over, literally over to their corner. It was pretty good that evening, actually, in the caucus itself.
By the end of the night, though, was there a sense on the ground there where you were in Des Moines that, wait a minute, this we're not kind of getting what we would normally expect, which is like some kind of sense of like, hey, we know what's going on, we know who's winning.
Yeah, no question about it. So following the caucus, I spent the rest of my evening at the Media Filing Center, which is where all the results were supposed to be coming in. The Republicans, who also held a caucus, posted their results very quickly, but they usually do because they basically just drop a piece of paper in a ballot box and it's counted. The Democrats have this much more complicated and social activity, but usually some results come in, you know, within a couple of hours. You know, 11 o'clock or so, 10:30 even, we're sitting there and the murmurs are kind of going around the center. All of the TV networks are all set up on risers with their stand-ups and everything ready to go. And we heard one anchor behind us basically say, I can't just fill for 4 minutes because they literally had nothing to say.
It's crazy. I mean, so what do you think this whole kind of snafu could do to Iowa's position as first in the primary process? I mean, there's already been more than a few people who question its position, saying, you know, Iowa plays an outsized role for a state that's not really reflective of the overall electorate. You know, could this mess be, as a few on social media put it, Biowa for Iowa?
The caucuses have been under pressure for a long time in terms of Iowa being first. And Iowa's first not because it was really planned out that way, but for various historical reasons. It's always been difficult to change simply because, well, 48 other states aren't particularly happy that Iowa and then New Hampshire lead the whole thing off. There's never been any way to agree on who else should do it or how else it should be run. And that's still the case. There are still people out there who believe that that's a powerful enough problem that nothing will change. That is, if California, for example, said, we want to go first, Texas might say, well, why you? It should be us. And New York might say, well, come on, and maybe Delaware, right?
Well, so, I've been around long enough to know that Delaware tried to do that
exactly.
once. They tried to supplant New Hampshire as the first primary, suggesting
exactly.
that Delaware at that particular time, which I believe was back in the 90s, was saying, hey, you know, Delaware, you know, is much more representative of the country.
Yeah.
You have kind of an
yeah.
urban center in the north, a rural area in the south. And the immediate reaction was like, heck no. And if you try it, nobody's going to come campaign in your little state.
Right, exactly. And to date, all of that approach has worked for both Iowa and New Hampshire. New Hampshire has it a little easier. They run a primary, and they can literally change the date of their primary on about 2 weeks' notice. Caucuses are far more complex and need months and months of planning for locations and what have you. So Iowa can't easily just change. A couple of cycles ago, basically, Iowa and New Hampshire came to a detente over this as long as Iowa was not a primary.
Right.
So the bottom line is this. There's going to be more pressure than ever to change it. There's no question about that. I don't think it's all completely fair. I think that some of the failure was a technology failure that should not have happened. But a lot of what the national media has been pointing out is simply the nature of a caucus, which is a meeting of party members in a voting district. And so the grassroots involved in that, the need for candidates to meet people, talk to them, shake their hands, learn from them, is one of the real advantages, even with its limitations.
So let's turn to the results. Pete Buttigieg, Bernie Sanders seem to be the, you know, for lack of a better term, winners here. Based on your time on the ground the last 6 months, is that at all surprising to you?
I think the Buttigieg numbers are a bit surprising. And if we look at what the polling was looking like going into the caucus, I think it's definitely the case that Buttigieg outperformed the final polls for him. And on the flip side, Joe Biden failed to meet the expectations that were set in the final polls. There were sort of eight last polls in which Sanders was up in four of them, and Biden was up in four of them. As we know, Biden ends up basically in fourth place, it looks like, substantially below his polling average. Sanders is right at his average, and Buttigieg is way above his. So by the history of the caucuses, Buttigieg would be the one to get the boost, not Sanders, who may or may not have actually won it. It looks pretty close to a virtual tie in
right.
the delegate count. But the person who beats the expectations, who does better than anyone imagined, is usually the one who gets the bump. And this time around, that is absolutely Pete Buttigieg. So is he getting a bump? Well, there have already been two polls out of New Hampshire, and you have to be careful drawing too much conclusion from that. But it does look like, even with all the uncertainty of the Iowa result, that Buttigieg may be gaining some traction from it.
So perhaps even with all this kind of confusion, there is, as you said, some momentum to be gained, maybe not as much as you
yeah.
would get in a more normal atmosphere.
I think that's right. And the interesting thing about this is that the media, and particularly like the New York Times and the AP, are very focused on who won the caucuses. But it looks very much, with most of the results in, like it really is extremely close, nearly a tie. And it is far less important who won from the standpoint of the process than how many delegates each candidate mm-hmm. gets to the national convention. Because in the end, it's about winning a majority of the National Convention delegates. And the estimations right now, which are not official at this point, is that both Sanders and Buttigieg will get the same number of pledged delegates out of this. So it's a tie on the measure that matters.
You mentioned Joe Biden. I want to talk about him in a little bit. But first,
yeah.
you know, we mentioned Bernie Sanders, and he did well. He kind of matches expectations,
mm-hmm.
probably a tie kind of coming out of Iowa. But the turnout was kind of meh. And some people had kind of predicted it would be higher, and suggestions were that, you know, the Sanders campaign is going to drive that turnout. He's got a lot
right.
of excitement around his campaign. Does the turnout numbers say anything about Sanders' argument that he brings people into the process, that that's kind of what he brings beyond just,
right.
you know, winning the Iowa caucus?
Well, I mean, we want to be a little bit careful about turnout numbers in a caucus. Caucuses aren't primaries or general elections. They are certainly much, you know, they take a lot more effort to come out and vote. So the turnout number, while it's some indication, it can't really be extrapolated to future primaries or future general elections. And people are doing that because up until now, we've seen pretty much a consistent increase in Democratic interest, voter interest, since Donald Trump was elected. And Democratic turnout has been up in every election since then. Democrats have flipped seats or come close in places they normally don't. And that's all been put down to Democratic enthusiasm.
Mm-hmm.
So I admit to being surprised personally that the turnout looks like it may be in the range of 2016, but not 2008, which was the big turnout year. But I think it's a couple things. I think Bernie Sanders absolutely excites his base, but there's no evidence he expanded his base.
Mm-hmm.
He, and of course, actually got half the vote he got 4 years ago if there were more candidates running. But rather than expand his base, what he seems to have done is simply increase his support among the youngest voters compared to 4 years ago, but not necessarily increase the number of the youngest voters who actually turned out, at least based on the entrance polls right now. So it's hard to make an argument that Sanders' campaign somehow uniquely engaged people.
And it's something we'll certainly keep an eye on as this process moves forward. I do want to turn back toward Delaware's own Joe Biden. As you mentioned, you know, a kind of disappointing fourth-place finish for Biden. He himself called it a gut punch. How much does this put a dent in his campaign? Or has some Biden folks have argued, you know, does the fact that the results were kind of delayed, everything kind of got muddled, there was the State of the Union, the impeachment trial mm-hmm. vote, the final vote, does that all kind of minimize the damage that would have been done perhaps in another year, another cycle?
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing, as I said, there may be some evidence of a bump for Pete Buttigieg in some polling in the last couple of days, but you would expect to see kind of the opposite for a candidate like Joe Biden, who failed to meet his expectations. And while he wasn't doing particularly well in New Hampshire in most of the polling before the Iowa caucuses, and it doesn't so far in these very early numbers, it does look like he's taken some hit in two polls that were in the field on caucus day and immediately after. So where Buttigieg has climbed, it does look like it's primarily at the expense of Joe Biden in New Hampshire. But for Biden, the more important question is going to be, can he hold his support in South Carolina,
right,
where African-American voters make up more than half the turnout? And to date, at least, he has had tremendous support among African-American voters. There's no new polling yet out of South Carolina, so it's really hard to see.
I guess we might not see anything like that until after New Hampshire, which would then
exactly.
kind of give you a real idea of where he stands after two contests. I do want to ask, though, why does Biden not seem to resonate in Iowa, in your opinion? You've been out there. You've been watching all this.
Yeah.
Is there a reason why Joe Biden just doesn't work in Iowa?
Well, you know, it's a funny question because I went to a number of his events, particularly in some more rural parts of Iowa, and he had decent-sized crowds for the size of the town. So you always have to be careful in measuring crowd size because, you know, if you're in one of these little towns of 4,000 people, that's different than Des Moines with, you know, hundreds of thousands of people available. And people seemed very engaged by him. I think in the end, it's probably two things. I think the rise of Buttigieg is part of it. They're not on much of the basic policy stuff. They're not dramatically different. And Biden's claim, his argument about experience, also has the challenge of pointing out that he's been around a long time,
mm-hmm.
and voters may have just been more interested in a new generation. So, you know, in a world in which Buttigieg had not done what he'd done, I think Biden would have done far, far better. Iowa Democrats are kind of split, as Democrats are nationally, between their progressive wing and their centrist wing. And the results of Iowa reinforce this. That is, about half the vote were cast for folks in the progressive wing, and about half of them cast for folks in the centrist wing. It's just that the progressive split, you know, Sanders, Warren, and the centrist, there are three candidates, and Buttigieg really, really took off. You know, talking about the top five here.
Sure. And having said that, I mean, looking at the rest of the field, you know, the two people we really didn't mention, you know, who finished kind of in the, you know, the top, you know, top part of things would be Warren and Senator Amy Klobuchar.
Right.
Does anything stand out about, you know, how they performed in Iowa and what that means going forward?
Klobuchar definitely had momentum moving into the end. You could see it. You could feel it. And it was hurt badly by her inability to be in Iowa. You know, and more than it was for Warren, in a sense. Warren really had been just kind of plateauing to a great extent. But Klobuchar seemed to be moving up. And I think that you know, in the end, it looks like she'll be relatively close to Biden, depending on what we're counting, if we're counting the votes themselves, for example. And I think that the Warren is kind of the interesting one. Of all the people, there's been a little bit of talk about Klobuchar. And of course, as we've been talking about Sanders, Biden, and Buttigieg, Warren's been left out of a lot of the conversation.
Sure.
I don't know if that's necessarily bad for her at the moment, but you know, it's certainly, you don't want to not be talked about in a positive way, I should say. I did want to say one other thing about Biden's campaign. Sure. One of the big challenges he had in Iowa, and I don't completely understand why, but it was quite clear that his ground game, his finding precinct captains and getting them trained and having a get-out-the-caucus operation, just did not stand up at all to the other front runners.
Hmm.
The precinct caucus that I went to, in the first alignment, Biden and Klobuchar each had 24 people. You needed 58 to be viable.
Right.
The Biden precinct people just kind of didn't seem to know what to do and didn't make any effort to, let's say, bring all the Klobuchar people over and find a few other people and maybe, if not a Biden delegate, at least deny Buttigieg
right.
or Warren or Sanders another delegate. Through uncommitted. But they did nothing. They just basically stood there. And I was really surprised by that.
It's interesting. Is there anything else you wound up taking away from all the time you spent in Iowa and watching this process kind of firsthand for that extended six-month period?
Yeah. Yeah, it reinforced for me the value of this kind of campaigning for presidential candidates. That is, the need to be on the ground, the need to talk to people. It doesn't happen a lot in high-level American politics. And as the campaigns move on from the early states, it won't happen much at all. There'll be large rallies. There'll be, you know, airport visits. But, you know, you can't campaign in California shaking the hands of virtually everyone who will vote for you.
Mm-hmm.
You can in Iowa. And I say shaking the hands, but what really matters there and what's really reinforced to me is how candidates can learn from voters. Just as much as voters learn from candidates. Andrew Yang's a case in point. While he didn't necessarily do particularly well, when he came to Iowa, the first time I saw him, he was absolutely one note. It was his freedom dividend. It was his free money for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And that was pretty much his entire campaign. By the end, he'd been asked hundreds of questions about all the other issues in all the town halls and events he'd had. I saw him at, I think, 8 or 10 events. And by the end, he had a far better grasp on the issues generally, and on the things voters cared about. It reinforced to me the value of this kind of early state campaigning. Whether it should be Iowa or not is less the issue than that there should be something like this.
David Redlass, Chair of the University of Delaware Department of Political Science and International Relations, we thank you so much for joining us on The Green this week.
Thanks for having me.